This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This past week, President Trump signed an executive order declaring English the official language of the United States. Sounds like a formality? Well, it's not. And for people who think this mainly affects Spanish-speaking people, think again. Issues of immigration go so much deeper. This weekend, we look at how issues like this affect Asian American communities, too. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. My guest this week is Grace Pai, Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. It's a three-decades-old group working to empower Asian communities across Chicago and Illinois. And if the past years, and especially this past month, have shown anything, it's that all immigrant communities are affected by the decisions and actions that are underway across the United States. Grace Pai has been with the organization since 2018. Before that, she worked with groups like the People's Lobby and Reclaim Chicago. In 2021, she spearheaded a campaign that led to Illinois becoming the first state to require Asian American history to be taught in all Illinois public schools. Sometime in this half hour, we're going to talk about how that policy may be affected by the current administration, too. We are conducting this interview via Zoom. Grace Pai, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is a lot on your plate these days and on the agendas of every organization dealing with immigrants. But let's start with that executive order on the nation's official language. The backers suggest it's simply making formal a reality that most people in this country speak English. What's the concern for Americans and immigrants who speak a language other than English at home?
The concern is that there's still rampant language discrimination across our country. It's really hard for people whose preferred language is not English to navigate things like social services or government services that they are absolutely entitled to, that they should be able to access without any barrier. But ask anyone who's from an immigrant family if they've had to translate for their relative or family friend or anyone else in their community. And many people have had to do that, unfortunately, sometimes even children. And, you know, kids really shouldn't be placed in that situation where they're feeling like they have to interpret for adults around them. Our government should really be taking that responsibility to ensure that we're not discriminating on the basis of where somebody may have come from. So it's really critical that we're, you know, supporting language access under, you know, in spite of all of these attacks. And to be honest, I mean, the United States has never had an official language. Why change that now? We should be uplifting the diversity and multilingual nature of our communities.
Except that if nothing else, we are having it writ large that that's exactly what this administration is not doing. There are Spanish language versions of many government websites. You can vote in Spanish, Polish, Cantonese, Tagalog. How much are you worried that those things are going to start to vanish? I mean, let's face it, they take effort, they take money.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, we are fortunate to be protected by federal legislation around language access in elections. But, you know, we have to be cautious and worried about what Congress might do. Right? We're already seeing pretty drastic measures being passed by Congress when it comes to immigration enforcement. And so, of course, we're concerned about language access being on the chopping block. The good news is that we have many, you know, state and local champions of language access who I think we can, you know, collaborate with and rely on to make sure that we are keeping language access. Mayor Johnson's defense of our city sanctuary city status this week before Congress was really important. And so I think that signals, you know, to immigrant communities that we will not back down as a city or a state.
Well, you know, a lot of online posts that I've read over the last week, and you know, it's not always good for mental health to read too much into what people are saying. But a lot of people are saying, "But if you want to be in this country, you have to assimilate." What do you say to those people who say that's part of the price you pay for being in America and living here?
I mean, honestly, assimilation, it's a huge cost. You know, ask anyone who's ever felt like they didn't belong somewhere how that felt. I think most people, that's a universal thing that people can relate to. It's not a good feeling. Why are we subjecting people to that, to live in a country that, you know, all of us call home? There's just no reason to feel the need to assimilate when we really see so much benefit coming from the diversity of people's backgrounds, right? There are all of these, right? DEI is under attack, obviously, right now, but, you know, even corporations have come around to the fact that diversity in the workforce is a good thing, that it helps, you know, business, it helps people connect to each other when you're coming from different backgrounds and when you have those different perspectives represented in the room. So, you know, I would say I really think the assimilation argument is kind of overblown, because everyone can relate to that feeling of lack of belonging, and that's what we're really talking about here.
And is that translating into feelings within communities, and, you know, not just the Asian American community, but, you know, Latin American communities, Haitian American communities, of people feeling as if now there's a target on them that you don't belong? Is that, how is that playing in those neighborhoods?
Of course. Yeah, we've absolutely heard that across, you know, all immigrant communities. We're a member of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights that has members that represent, you know, Latino folks, African immigrants, Black immigrants, right? People from Arab Americans, right? People who come from all different parts of the world, or who draw their roots from all different parts of the world. And we are hearing that across the board, that, you know, anytime that there's been a crisis in this country, honestly, some group has been scapegoated, right? Whether it's Asian Americans during the auto crisis in the 80s, or Chinese Americans, you know, over COVID, and, you know, or Arab Americans and South Asians after 9/11. We see that finger pointing time and time again. And so, unfortunately, this is just another case of that happening, right? I think for all communities of color, people can relate to that, you know, feeling of being treated as, you know, the cause of something that they're absolutely not the cause for, right? Being blamed in that way, kind of. So, you know, I think that it is really sad to see the fear and that just that anxiety, right? Of like, oh, are my neighbors looking at me differently now? Right? That's a unfortunately all too common experience.
Mm-hmm. And in this time when the administration is talking about and trying to affect mass deportations, that is not some, while a lot of the public stuff is happening in Latino communities, there are actions, and I understand, and certainly some fears within the Asian community. Talk a little bit about what you're hearing, and frankly, what your organization is doing.
Absolutely. There is fear of mass deportations impacting Asian American communities. You're right that most of the focus has been on Latino communities. And, you know, I think it's just a matter of time before the scope is broadened. And, you know, I mean, people are worried because the majority of Asian Americans are immigrants. That is something that actually sets us apart from other racial groups in the US. Like, more than half of Asian Americans who are here immigrated from another country. And so that puts us at greater risk in that sense. And 1 in 8 Asian Americans is undocumented, right? It's more prevalent than people might think. But we know that the Trump administration is probably going to go after not just undocumented immigrants, but naturalized citizens as well, right? We're seeing already the attacking of birthright citizenship, right? He's trying to take away citizenship from people, including, you know, a lot of Asian Americans who, you know, are expecting kids or who want to start families here. So it's deeply concerning. And I think we've, you know, just been facing a lot of that uncertainty. That's the hard part about all of this, right, is that there's what the Trump administration says, and then there's what this Trump administration does. And we're waiting to see, you know, what it actually looks like in practice.
How confident are you that at least the executive order rescinding birthright citizenship will be eventually done away with? The Constitution of the United States seems pretty clear, but all of these things get, you know, go up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, we've seen a slew of court rulings. Pausing, right, the implementation of that executive order. And so, you know, we are, I think, looking to see that go to the Supreme Court. And of course, that's another big, you know, area of uncertainty is how the Supreme Court will rule on this. But I do think the Constitution is clear, and this is a huge constitutional attack. You know, our president is trying to undo the literal Constitution. Like, that can't be understated. And I think that, you know, there are some really strong legal defenses as to why birthright citizenship, you know, needs to continue.
One of the things that your organization was instrumental in was passing the Language Equity and Access Act in 2024. This goes back to our first point about official languages and such, but that requires state agencies to create and implement language access policies to ensure that Illinoisans get what they need. How could that be affected by what's going on nationally?
I mean, fortunately, right, states have the ability to enact their own legislation, and that's part of why we have fought so hard for language protections to be enshrined in our state statute. We don't want to rely on just the federal government, right? And as we can see, like, for good reason, because everything is being rolled back at the federal level. So, you know, I'm really glad that we got that passed last year, kind of just in time. And, you know, I think it's largely protected, right? The state legislature would have to pass new legislation to change that. And, you know, we're confident that our state legislature will stand by those language protections. But, you know, I think, like many nonprofit organizations, the state government is also concerned about federal funding cuts, right? And so we'll see the trickle-down effect of that. It won't directly impact our legislation. And, you know, state agencies, we will still be held accountable to creating language access plans. And hopefully the federal environment, if anything, motivates them, you know, to do as much as they possibly can to meet the needs of immigrant Illinoisans, because the federal government is falling short.
Let's talk about the act that I mentioned at the beginning, which is the passing the Teaching Equitable Asian American Community History Act, which was 2021, and you were very much involved in that. Illinois is the first state in the country to require Asian American history to be taught in public schools. How safe is that?
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, we're also pretty confident that that will stick around, you know, in part because our state has such a robust commitment to inclusive history education. Asian American history is just one of many inclusive history mandates at the state level. Of course, we require Black history to be taught in public schools, LGBTQ history, Muslim American history, and newly Native American history. So, you know, I think there is that commitment from the State Board of Education to ensure that our public schools are teaching an inclusive curriculum. But of course, right, with the attempts to dismantle the Department of Education at the federal level, we can't, you know, take anything for granted. And so certainly I'm sure, you know, folks are worried about funding cuts or, you know, any other attempts to roll back federal oversight.
How concerned are you about Supreme Court rulings and other court rulings that see some things perhaps like this as sort of affirmative action? I mean, in other words, that there are going to be lawsuits by people saying it's not fair to have certain types of history taught versus others. Are you expecting that you're going to see some resistance? I mean, I've heard people talking about what kind of things can we now file?
The reality is we're already teaching selective history. This is about whose histories are being left out, right? Whose histories don't get included. So really what these pieces of legislation require is that we teach the truth of the history of America, right? That we don't teach it just from the perspective of one group, but that we teach everyone's perspective. And so in that sense, you know, I think these are really defensible positions. This shouldn't be something considered radical or kind of in the category of DEI, because we're talking about history, right? Just things that have happened in the past, and whether we teach the full version or whether we teach the selective version.
But there seem to be some areas, and Florida being an example, where they're saying, yeah, we want the selective version, where you can't teach about race. You can't teach about gender. Do those kinds of concerns come up when we're dealing even in Illinois, a blue state, but nevertheless a state that has geographic differences?
Yeah, you know, I think we're lucky to be in a state like Illinois that has so staunchly defended inclusive education. You know, definitely I see what's happening in Florida. And part of that is, you know, part of this extreme right wing agenda to completely rewrite our history books and to really, you know, enact this right wing agenda of not talking about race, the kind of culture wars type stuff. And so I think, you know, I feel lucky to live in a state where I haven't seen a lot of that when it comes to education. And certainly, you know, there are many organizations and constituencies that would fight back hard against any effort like that here.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore, and we're talking about immigration, citizenship, culture, and the law with Grace Pye, Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. I guess I want to ask a more philosophical question, because what brings immigrants to the United States is this American, you know, this thought of the American dream of what this country can mean for people from around the world, when it has been seen as a welcoming country. Do you see some disillusion with that now? Are people now having second thoughts about that kind of thing?
Absolutely. I think many Americans know that the American dream is a myth. And immigrants certainly know that better than most. Right, people who come here kind of enticed by these dreams of economic prosperity or being able to, you know, climb up the ladder of meritocracy, they arrive and they realize that that's not reality here. And, you know, that is heartbreaking for many people. I mean, I think we've seen news reports of especially like Venezuelan asylum seekers who have arrived and been like, this is not what I thought it would be, right? This sort of picture that is painted of what America is abroad is not reflective of what America is, you know, once you are here. So certainly there is that, you know, big gap. And, you know, I mean, I think our goal as Advancing Justice Chicago and as, you know, people who are trying to make this a better place, right? Our vision is for it to be a place where people can access that opportunity and prosperity that they hope for. But we do have a long way to go to making that reality.
Are you seeing a lot of anti-Asian sentiment still? Obviously, during COVID, there were people fueling that, but what's the atmosphere like now?
Well, it's a little complicated. You know, it's hard to kind of tease out anti-Asian sentiment versus anti-immigrant sentiment or xenophobia. And certainly we've seen, you know, rampant xenophobia fueled by, you know, the president's campaign rhetoric about immigrants, you know, both from the first campaign and this second one. And that is, you know, very much creating this like chilling effect in communities, right? Like, especially paired with the deportation efforts, or people are afraid to be out, you know, just living their day-to-day lives, taking their kids to school, going to work, all of that has been very disruptive. But in terms of the particular, you know, Asian American impact, I do think we've seen some of the waning of anti-Asian sentiment, you know, as COVID has kind of become a little bit more normalized. But at the same time, you know, you see President Trump escalating tensions with China, right? And that kind of that has also been a big part of campaign rhetoric. He said at a campaign rally before he was elected that he was going to try to deport military age Chinese men first. So we still see that sort of singling out, especially of Chinese Americans. But, you know, it's a little hard to pull that out from general anti-immigrant sentiment.
Now, as a leader of an organization that does try to empower people in the community, does this kind of pressure help bring pan-Asian communities together more?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we say is that Asian American, it's a choice to identify as Asian American. That Asian American is not a sort of natural identity for most people, right? They grow up identifying with their particular ethnic group, you know, Indian American or Korean American, Chinese American or Vietnamese American. But, you know, banding together as the Asian American community is necessary to build political power and to advocate on behalf of our communities. And so, you know, I think that that's the history of the term too, right? This term came about in the 60s and 70s, inspired by the Black Power movement, where Asian Americans realized, hey, if we want to have a voice, we have to come together, you know, as a group. We can't be divided or sort of in our own little subgroups. You know, we have to build this pan-Asian identity. And so my organization absolutely is part of that legacy, you know, that we really believe that if we're going to be able to change policies for the better, if we're going to be able to mobilize Asian Americans to take part in democratic processes, that we have to do so as a united group.
What can organizations do beyond teaching people their rights? What's the work that you're doing right now as we are going through this landscape?
You know, I think it's been really hopeful to see community members really band together in defense of their neighbors. So one of the things that we're doing is with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant Refugee Rights, you know, we are leading a rapid response team on the north side of Chicago that can respond to rumored ICE sightings. So if someone calls into the hotline and says, hey, you know, I think that there's ICE agents in my neighborhood, we can dispatch a team of people to verify that. Because one of the things that we're really concerned about, right, is the rumor mill, just kind of spreading that fear without it being, you know, actual ICE activity. So, you know, we've seen so many people who are not immigrants, right, who don't come from immigrant backgrounds coming together to be that that support for other people. And then, of course, at the policy level, we have to fight back. At the local level, there's opportunities to strengthen our welcoming policies. You know, Chicago is lucky to have, a welcoming city ordinance that prevents collaboration between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. We have at the state level as well through the Illinois Trust Act. You know, we want to bolster those. And of course, at the federal level, you know, try whatever we can to defend against these anti-immigrant attacks. You know, there are slim margins in Congress. And so, you know, making sure that all of our Illinois Congress people know where we stand when it comes to defending, you know, our immigrant neighbors.
Well, I on a personal note, because I want to talk about something else, but I this is a time to remember you lost a former executive director, Tuet Lay. She died almost exactly a month ago of cancer. She has been on this program before. I met her during an aldermanic remap, of all things, she was trying to make sure that there was better representation in Congress, on the city council. And in fact, Tuet was trying to make sure that when they redrew the lines, because, you know, those of us who've been around long enough remember that Chinatown used to be divided into six different wards. So completely impossible for there to be an Asian American representative from that area. That paved the way for Nicole Lee eventually to be the alder person. She was a joyful, I guess this is a better word, person, and such a hard worker. That my condolences to you and your team. But I mean, you have to you. She set a real path, didn't she?
She was a trailblazer. Absolutely. She really, she did not take no for an answer. And she was really relentless. You know, I think when I think of Tuet's legacy, I'm just so grateful to follow in her footsteps and to be part of an organization that she literally built from the ground up. You know, when she started working at Advancing Justice Chicago, there were two staff, you know, not even two full-time staff. And by the time she left, we were at 15 strong. You know, that's truly remarkable to have built an organization from nothing and to have fought such milestone fights, you know, like ensuring that Asian Americans weren't excluded from the city of Chicago's minority contracting program for construction. You know, like there were these big fights, redistricting you talked about, that she started, led, and won, you know, some of which weren't won for many years, but others of which, you know, she really was able to see through to victory. So it's a huge loss to our community. And, you know, the thing that I'm so grateful for is that she was such an intentional mentor to so many young people and up and coming leaders within our community that, you know, her presence will be felt for decades to come.
Tell me a Tuet story, tell me what you think would remind people of what kind of a person she was.
Well, I mean, one of her, she had a couple of go-to quips at our office. and one of them was, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness. You know, and so that really encapsulates what she was about, how she led, that she wasn't afraid to stand up to, you know, people who said no, people in power, right? People who didn't think that the Asian American community was worth listening to. And she organized the first Asian American mayoral forum, you know, where that was interpreted into multiple Asian languages. This was in 2011, I think. And Rahm Emanuel was the only candidate who didn't attend, you know, and she called him out, right? And had an empty seat at the table for him. All other candidates were there, but mobilizing 1,000 Asian Americans to take part in a historic mayoral election, that was the kind of leader that she was. And truly, you know, we will miss her so, so deeply.
Well, and those of us who covered the issues and those of us who got to know her will miss her as well. I'm glad we had time to talk about her because she was quite a force. But anyway, I would like to thank Grace Pai, the director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice, for spending this time with us. To our listeners, if you would like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website. That's WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage. You can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We will be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is News Radio 105.9 WBBM.